Good afternoon. This is the Maggie Dawn Show here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me this afternoon. My name is Jim Santel, and for this hour and next hour too, I'm going to be guest hosting the Maggie Dawn Show. Maggie away just this week doing some important work in another venue and coming back next week to resume the control of the show and also bring you more important discussion about issues significant in our lives. But today, for this hour and next hour, Jim Santel here in the WAUK studios in downtown Waukesha with my wonderful producer, Calvin. And together, we're going to bring you a part of the Maggie Dawn Show focusing today upon voting. Voting and elections. We know well that in about 4 days from now, four short days from now, Wisconsin and many other places around the nation, many of our citizens, our residents are going to the polls. And so with Maggie's okay, her endorsement, today we're going to talk all things voting, all things elections, all things polling related. And our agenda in particular includes a first hour focusing a lot upon voting in America, going back and doing a bit of a short history, an abbreviated review of where we have come throughout our nation's history to bring us to this point in 2024, talking about the developments of voting rights in our great nation, the challenges, the ups, the downs, the circuitous movement from the time of the founding of our nation until today. We're going to talk a lot about history this afternoon as a part of our devotion here on the Maggie Dawn Show, Civic Media, to voting, voting, voting. As I said, I am here in the studios of Civic Media in downtown Waukesha, but inviting also your questions, your comments, your insights, your perspectives at this number, 844-855-752-4842. That number one more time, 855-752-4842. And Calvin and I will take your phone calls, especially your questions, in this hour and the next hour as well, as we talk here on the Maggie Dawn Show all about voting. In our second hour, a special guest, a very special guest joining us. Her name is Kristen Hansen. She has been on the shows, the broadcast presentations of Civic Media previously, coming in to talk with me and talk with you as well, all about the nuts and bolts of voting. All kinds of aspects relevant to voting here in the state of Wisconsin and throughout our nation. We're inviting Kristen to our discussion, inviting you to that discussion as well, again at 855-752-4842. That is in our second hour. Throughout this hour and also next hour, we're going to be guided by and animated by some fundamental notions about the importance of voting here in the United States of America and right here in the state of Wisconsin as well. We know that our Supreme Court on many occasions in recent times and in previous generations has rendered opinions on the all-important notions of voting in our democracy. Chief Justice Earl Warren in 1964, in a major case called Reynolds versus Sims, spoke about the right to vote as being at the foundation of our democracy. He said this. He said the right to vote freely for the candidate of one's choice is of the essence of a democratic society, and any restrictions on that right strike at the heart of representative government. That's Chief Judge Justice Earl Warren, 1964. He went on to say this. Undoubtedly, the right of suffrage is a fundamental matter in a free and democratic society, especially since, as he wrote further, the right to exercise the franchise in a free and unimpaired manner is preservative of the other basic civil and political rights. Any alleged infringement of the right of citizens to vote must be carefully and meticulously scrutinized. In other words, voting as the gateway, as the threshold to all the other rights that we hold so dear, not only under our constitution of our government, of our nation, but also the constitution of the state of Wisconsin, the ways in which we think about how our government should work and our population generally should work in electing people to positions of responsibility representing us in houses of government. That from Chief Justice Earl Warren in 1964, Reynolds versus Sims. There's more. Justice Hugo Black, that same year, 1964, shared that same sentiment. He wrote in Westbury versus Sanders, he wrote this. He said, "No right is more precious in a free country than that of having a voice in the election of those who make the laws under which, as good citizens, we must live. Other rights, even the most basic, are illusory if the right to vote is undermined." Once again, this fundamental notion, as Justice Hugo Black is telling us in mid-1960s, all about the threshold nature of voting, voting as the gateway to everything else that we do. Thus, it is appropriate today on the Maggie Dawn Show that we devote this hour and next hour as well to voting, elections, and polling here in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Thank you for joining me and Calvin. That telephone number, once again, 855-752-4842. During the course of our hour, these segments coming up and the next segments when Kristen Hansen will be with me to talk about the practical trappings of all of these important issues. In both hours, we're going to be featuring a recent album released by Effa O'Donovan. Effa O'Donovan is an American singer. She's a Grammy Award-winning songwriter, best known perhaps as the lead singer for the string band Crooked Still. Effa O'Donovan also co-founded the Grammy Award-winning female folk trio I'm With Her. Effa O'Donovan recently, as in last week, just released a brand new album, March 22nd, called All My Friends. Effa O'Donovan, a new album called All My Friends, and featured in that album from Effa O'Donovan is a major new piece called The Right Time. And she devotes it to a woman named Carrie Chapman Catt. Some, if not all of you, may know about Carrie Chapman Catt. She is a lion. She is an icon in the history of America and a major figure in our history. 1859, born right here in Wisconsin, in the city of Ripon, state of Wisconsin, died in 1947. And in between her birth and her death, a major, major player in the area of voting rights for America. In particular, again, Carrie Chapman Catt, the featured and honored person in this new song called The Right Time by Effa O'Donovan, this new piece coming out just last week, Carrie Chapman Catt. American women's civil suffrage leader who had campaigned for, yes, that's right, the passage of the 19th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which, as we all know, gave U.S. women the right to vote in 1920. She served as president of something called the National American Women Suffrage Association from 1900 to 1904, and again from 1915 to 1920. She was the founder, Carrie Chapman Catt, the founder of the League of Women Voters in 1920, and also the International Women Suffrage Alliance in 1904, later named the International Alliance of Women. Historians have described her this way. They said she led an army of voteless women in 1990 to pressure Congress to pass the constitutional amendment, giving them the right to vote, and she convinced state legislatures also to ratify it in 1920, again, changing forever the geography, the important geography of voting in America. Another historian said she was one of the best-known women in the United States in the first half of the 21st century, I would add throughout our nation's history, on the list of all famous American women. I would add all famous Americans for what she did. Carrie Chapman Catt, she was a successor in many ways to Susan B. Anthony. She was her hand-picked successor and led the fight. Brought the fight beyond passage of the 1919 Amendment, the 1920 Amendment, that gave women finally the right to vote in America. She is memorialized and she is honored in this piece, written, authored, presented by Effa O'Donovan, called The Right Time, in her new album, All My Friends. And Calvin and I are going to be presenting that to you during the course of this hour and next. You're going to hear a lot of Effa O'Donovan this hour and next as a part of our salute today to voting. And yes, our salute to the right of women and of all eligible people, all of our residents, our citizens to vote in our nation. We're going to talk a lot about the expansion of that right during the course of our nation's history, beginning right now. Let's talk a short history, if you will, this hour about voting rights in America.
The struggle for equal voting rights from the earliest days of our U.S. history has been serpentine. It's been circuitous, if you will, not always a straight arrow. Challenges to voting rights in this country, like many of those that we have seen recently, we're going to chat about some of those in our first and second hours here as well. Hardly a 21st century invention. In fact, much of our history, throughout our history, groups have tried to keep the vote out of the hands of less powerful people. Indeed, America began its great democratic experiment in the late 1700s, as you all well know, by granting the right to vote to a very narrow subset of our society. And those people, they were white male landowners. And even as barriers to voting over time began receding in some of the ensuing decades, as we're going to chat during the course of this hour, there were other hurdles to voting that were put up. And we're going to chat about a lot of those during the course of our discussion this afternoon. Also, again, inviting your comments and questions. Highlights of our upcoming historical discussion include, of course, the landmark Voting Rights Act of 1965. We're going to talk about some of the things that it provides. It is still in place, although we're also going to talk about the ways in which the United States Supreme Court, in a couple of cases, one of them called Shelby County versus Holder, and another one called Brnovich versus DNC, both of those cases from the pens of a majority of our Supreme Court, have dramatically impacted the effect of the Voting Rights Act. Remedies for that pending in the Congress, we'll talk about those as well. And of course, we'll talk about the expansion in our Constitution from those early days, when our so-called founding fathers established the Constitution through a course of amendments, expanding the franchise appropriately to groups not identified in 1787 at the time of the writing of our Constitution. Indeed, despite their beliefs in the virtues of democracy, many of the wonderful things incorporated into our Constitution, even established in the first Congress right after our nation was born in the 10 Amendments, the Bill of Rights to our Constitution, the founders of the United States accepted and endorsed severe limits on voting. As we come back, we're going to talk more about those limitations. We're going to talk about how those were undermined eventually and then brought back in some ways during the course of our discussion this afternoon. I'll give you something to talk about.
Maggie Dawn Show, and my name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie Dawn in this hour and next hour, talking with you all about voting in America, in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Also taking your calls at 855-752-4842. Calvin and I, delighted to hear from you during the course of this hour and next, as we talk in this hour all about the history of voting rights in America, and then in our second hour, talk more practically about some of the trappings of contemporary voting with my special guest, Kristen Hansen, going to be in the studio here of Civic Media. Talking initially about the incarnation in our original Constitution of this notion that only a narrow subset of our society, that is white male landowners, initially could vote. Indeed, the Constitution originally left it to the states, the individual states, to determine who is qualified to vote in those elections. And pursuant to that, state legislatures generally restricted voting to white males who owned property, consistent with what was set forth in our Constitution. Some states, as we also know, also employed religious tests to ensure that only Christian men could vote. And eventually, over time, during the early part of the 19th century, some state legislatures began to limit the property requirement for voting. And we saw that in the course of some of the legislative enactments, as those barriers established initially in the Constitution slowly, imperfectly, but slowly began to recede. Later, during the Reconstruction period following the Civil War,
Congress passed, as you all well know, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, a major amendment, the first major change in our Constitution having to do with voting rights. And what did it do? It ensured that people could not be denied the right to vote because of their race. Plainly, one of the many post-civil rights amendments passed into the Constitution, enacted in our Constitution at that time. The amendment ratified by the states in 1870. However, in the decade that follows, as we also know, many states, particularly in the South, but not exclusively in the South, employed a range of barriers, including things like poll taxes, having to pay to vote, and literacy tests, having to take a test to determine whether you are literate or not, to deliberately reduce voting among African-American men. Early in the 20th century, as we said at the outset of our broadcast this afternoon, women were still only able to vote in a handful of states. And yes, indeed, some states preceded the Constitution, preceded the nation as a whole in granting the franchise to women. And after decades of organizing and activism and advocacy, women finally won the right to vote with the ratification of what we know today as the 19th Amendment. We're honoring today one of the people who was responsible for that advocacy, for accomplishing that. Her name is Carrie Chapman Catt. She is memorialized. She is memorialized today in the music from Ava O'Donovan in her song, The Right Time, and other tracks from her new album called All My Friends. In celebration of the 19th Amendment, women nationwide finally winning the right to vote with the ratification of that amendment in 1920, just 100 years ago. In 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution passed, another change, a movement forward toward greater extension of the franchise. And the struggle for voting rights, of course, came to a head, as many of you may recall, in the 1960s, as many states, particularly in the South, but not exclusively, dug in on some of these long-standing policies, including these things like literacy tests, that is, having to take an examination to determine whether you understand how to read and write, and also poll taxes, having to pay a fee, having to pay money to come in and vote at a polling place. There were English language requirements that were imposed by some states, and more, all of them aimed at suppressing the vote among people of color, immigrants, and also low-income populations. In March of 1965, as I suspect we all know based upon our history, some of you probably alive as well, activists organized some protest marches from Selma, Alabama, to the state capitol there, Montgomery, to spotlight these problems, these issues of black voting rights and the prohibitions effectively placed upon people of color voting in many states. Selma, Alabama, the place of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, the site of this first march brutally attacked by police. Others on that day, you know, that day came to be known as Bloody Sunday. I will tell you that one of the highlights, one of the most memorable parts of my time as a U.S. attorney in eastern Wisconsin was to join then Attorney General Eric Holder, and then the President of the United States, also Barack Obama, at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge on the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday. We gathered together on that day to commemorate the horror that happened on that day, but also to recommit, as all Americans do and continue to do, to advance the rights of voting for all Americans, including people of color. After a second march in the wake of Bloody Sunday, again in March of 1965, the march was cut short. Throngs of thousands of people finally making the journey across the bridge, arriving in Montgomery on March 24th and drawing nationwide attention to this issue. Part of our history, Edmund Pettus Bridge, the 50th anniversary, actually now the 59th anniversary this year of that Bloody Sunday event, and the marches that took place right after that. Now, what did those accomplish? They accomplished a lot, even though the effort continued. Poll taxes, as we know, were a particularly egregious form of voter suppression. For a century following the Civil War, even after the enactment of the 15th Amendment, the 19th Amendment as well, requiring people to pay money to vote. That payment of taxes was regarded as a prerequisite for voter registration in many states. The taxes were expressly designed undeniably to keep African-Americans and low-income white people from voting. Some states even enacted, even passed in their legislatures, grandfather clauses that allowed many higher-income white people to avoid paying the taxes, an overtly racist attempt to try to prevent people of color from voting, even in the wake of the 15th Amendment. The 24th Amendment was approved by Congress in 1962, finally in 1962, and it was ratified by states 2 years later. In a 1966 case, the Supreme Court ruled that poll taxes are unconstitutional in any U.S. election. And finally, poll taxes as a way of limiting voting for people of color and people of all incomes, no longer a part of our laws, no longer permitted constitutionally in our Constitution by virtue of the 24th Amendment, by virtue of the Supreme Court decision in 1966. All of this happening, of course, during the 1960s and inspired in many ways by that Voting Rights March in Alabama in the spring of 1965. Congress finally passes something called the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now, what does it do? The vote was decisive, and it was also significantly in that year. It was also bipartisan, a vote of 79-18 in the Senate and also 328-74 in the House. Imagine that in the middle of the 1960s. Imagine that today in the time of a divided government, the passage in 1965 of the Voting Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson signed the measure on August 6th. He had with him at that time Dr. Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, and other icons of the civil rights movement who are part of our history on his side. As he's doing that, passing out the pens at that time. Our discussion of voting rights in America, including what happens after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, continues this afternoon.
All my friends, all my friends will meet the end.
This is the Maggie Dawn Show. My name is Jim Santel, sitting in for Maggie this afternoon as we talk all about voting in America, voting in the state of Wisconsin. My wonderful producer and Calvin and I are here in the studios of Civic Media, also taking your phone calls and your notes at 855-752-4842. In the remaining segments of this hour, talking more about the history of voting, the franchise in our great nation, in our great state, the ups, the downs, the in-betweens of all of that and where we are today. And then in our second hour, joined by a very special guest. Her name is Kristen Hansen, and she and I are together going to be talking about the trappings of voting coming up not just on April 4th, but down the road as well here in the state of Wisconsin, other places throughout our nation. Talking about the major voting rights legislation passed by our Congress in 1965, the spring of 1965, the Voting Rights Act of that year, signed by Lyndon Johnson in the presence of people like Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks, other icons of the civil rights movement, in the wake of, in the midst of the attempts by Americans of all colors to attempt to increase the franchise, to ensure that the prejudice and the bias, the racism that animated and still does animate some of our voting in our nation, that is a thing of the past. That was the purpose behind the Voting Rights Act. And indeed, at the time of the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, amended to enforce the 14th Amendment, certainly, but the 15th Amendment in particular, to secure the right to vote for racial minorities throughout the country, especially but not exclusively in the South, according to the U.S. Department of Justice at that time and since that time, the Act, the most effective piece of federal civil rights legislation ever enacted in this country. The National Archives and Records Administration describes it this way. It says the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was the most significant statutory change in the relationship between the federal and state governments in the area of voting since the Reconstruction period following the Civil War. Indeed, it was. The Voting Rights Act included provisions that required states and local jurisdictions with a historical pattern, approved pattern of suppressing voting rights based upon race, to submit their changes in their election laws to the United States Department of Justice before those could go into effect. That's called the pre-approval or pre-clearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act, put into the law as a part of the congressional action at that time. And in the following decades, this pre-clearance procedure, this process by which jurisdictions that had historically discriminated against people of color in voting, proved to be, frankly, a remarkably effective means of discouraging state and local entities from establishing, from enforcing new barriers for voting, stopping the most egregious policies from going into effect. Why? Because, yes, you had people at the Department of Justice looking at them, examining them, determining whether or not they were consistent, not just with the Voting Rights Act, but also with our Constitution, providing communities and civil rights advocates around the nation with advance notice of proposed of changes that might suppress the vote, giving Americans the chance to weigh in on those changes before they went into effect. We're going to talk in just a minute or so about the major impact that a Supreme Court case called Shelby County had upon that key provision, sections 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Let's get back to some history inside our Constitution even so. For much of the nation's history, states generally restricted voting to people age 21 and older. But again, during the 1960s, this period of time that we're talking about a lot today, the movement to lower voting rights to an age lower than 21 gained a considerable amount of steam with the rise of student activism, in particular, of course, the war in Vietnam, which was fought principally, almost exclusively, by young 18 and over draftees. The 26th Amendment prohibited states and federal government agencies from using age as a reason to deny the vote to anyone 18 years of age or over. Again, the 26th Amendment establishing the right to vote for anyone 18 years or older. 1975, the Voting Rights Act is expanded to protect language minorities. Congress adding new provisions to the Voting Rights Act to protect members of language minority groups. The amendments require jurisdictions with significant numbers of voters who have limited or no proficiency in English provide voting materials to other languages and to provide multilingual assistance even at the polls. When Krista and I, in our next hour, talk about that, we're going to talk about our own experiences. I serve as a poll worker, and yes, indeed, as a part of the places around the nation, including the place where I work as a poll worker, mechanisms to ensure not only access to the polls, but that language minority groups also have access and have the ability to vote under and pursuant to their own languages, multilingual assistance at the polls. 1982, Congress requires new voting protections for people with disabilities, passed a law extending the Voting Rights Act in 1982 for another 25 years. 25 years extending the impact of the Voting Rights Act. And as a part of that important extension at that time, Congress required all states to take steps, affirmative action, some things they needed to do to make voting more accessible for the elderly and people with disabilities, again, as a part of the movement toward a greater franchise. And then in 1993, something called the Motor Voter becomes law. What is this all about? Again, responding to some historically low rates of voter registration, Congress passed something called the National Voter Registration Act. It was also known as Motor Voter. The law requiring states, again, in 1993, to allow citizens to register to vote when they applied for their driver's licenses. In other words, when you go in to get a driver's license, let's register to you to vote at the same time. The law requires states to offer mail-in registration and also to allow people to vote at offices offering public assistance. All that as a part of, again, an additional legislative enactment to expand the Voting Rights Act. In the first year of its implementation, just like the dramatic impacts on the racial minorities in our nation, enabling them to vote in the wake of the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, in the wake of the passage of the Motor Voter Law in 1993, more than 30 million people completed their voter registration applications or updated their registration through means made available because of that law. Now, as we move forward into the 21st century, we know well that election problems spotlight the highlight and need for reform in our nation. Recall well the 2000 election, the Gore-Bush presidential race that leads to this recount in the state of Florida.
heightened many of the concerns plaguing U.S. elections. Some faulty equipment, some bad ballot designs, inconsistent rules, and procedures across some local jurisdictions and states that needed attention. The U.S. Supreme Court, as you know, ultimately intervened to stop the Florida recount in Bush versus Gore. Again, a major decision by the Supreme Court, ultimately ensuring the election of George W. Bush. We know, however, that in 2002, Congress passed something called the Help America Vote Act. With memories of that 2000 election in sharp detail, still fresh in the minds of everyone, including legislators, Congress passes the Help America Vote Act in 2002, the idea to streamline election procedures across the nation. The law placed new mandates on states and also localities across the country to replace some outdated voting equipment, to create some new statewide voter registration lists, and provide what are called provisional ballots to ensure that eligible voters are not turned away if their names are not on the roll of registered voters. Now, there's all sorts of ways to address some concerns from the 2000 election, doing some practical things. Likewise, the Help America Vote Act, expanding this notion of access to the franchise at that time. The law also was designed to make it easier for people, once again, with disabilities to cast private, independent ballots, things once again done at polling places throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. In June of 2013, as I mentioned before, the first of two major cases issued by our United States Supreme Court that struck a blow from which we have not recovered to the Voting Rights Act of 1965. I described before these pre-clearance procedures where those jurisdictions around the nation, not just in the South, around the nation that had a history of discriminating against people based upon their racial status, the color of their skin. If you've established a history of doing that, before you can change the laws, the practices, the procedures in your jurisdiction, you had to get pre-clearance under the Voting Rights Act. In June of 2013, the Supreme Court all but guts that provision. A case called Shelby County versus Holder, and yes, the holder of that case is my former boss, Eric Holder, the former Attorney General of the United States of America. The Supreme Court effectively, as I said, gutting the Voting Rights Act. Because of that decision, states and localities with this history, this proven history, this established record of suppressing voting rights, were no longer required to submit changes in the election laws to the U.S. Justice Department for this pre-clearance or this review process. A 5-4 decision in June of 2013, ruling unconstitutional that very section that I described before of the 1965 law that was really key to protecting voters in states and localities with a history of voter-based voter suppression. And the racial minorities identified in those jurisdictions no longer have this pre-clearance procedure to protect them from these kinds of inappropriate and biased and unconstitutional procedures. The Supreme Court now saying that because of the change in time, the Chief Justice at that time, John Roberts, writing that effectively because the standards, the history of America has changed since 1965, we no longer can embrace the mechanisms by which that pre-clearance procedure was enacted and continued to be effective during the course of the many years since 1965. Because times have changed, he basically said, that pre-clearance mechanism, the pre-clearance test in the Voting Rights Act of 1965 can no longer stand. Significantly, a major dissent in that case, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, former Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, another lion, another icon on Supreme Court history and American history as well. She famously said this in dissent, outraged by the fact that the Supreme Court is decimating this major enforcement mechanism under the Voting Rights Act. She says this. She says, throwing out preclearance when it has worked, and indeed it did. All the statistics were that it had worked effectively, not completely, but effectively. She says, throwing out preclearance procedures when they worked and are continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. Indeed, Ruth Bader Ginsburg had it just right in 2013. And there are many enactments, many proposals to enact what are called Shelby County fixes pending in the Congress. They've been introduced in the Congress in every single Congress, 2013. They variously have passed the House of Representatives, but they have not passed the entire Congress because of decisions by the Senate, by the House, not to get those pieces of legislation to the president's desk. And because of that, to this day, Sections 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act are no longer effective. They're no longer in place. And we know, of course, in the wake, almost immediately in 2013, June, July, August of 2013, states throughout the nation begin to enact on their own initiative, without this preclearance requirement, various laws that are seen by many and did in fact accomplish a suppression of the votes of people of color. Here are some of them. North Carolina, one of many, many similar laws passed in the wake of that 2013 Shelby ruling. Texas officials similarly pass a law that is discriminatory, enacted, believe it or not, on the same day that Shelby is decided. It institutes a strict voter identification law that previously had been blocked under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act because of its impact on suppressing the vote of low-income people and racial minorities. And after a successful civil rights lawsuit brought by the U.S. Department of Justice and others, the North Carolina law was ultimately struck down by a federal judge who said that because it targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision, officials in that state could no longer enforce it. But even though there have been movements forward, also movements back, in states like Alabama, Mississippi, Florida, Virginia, shortly after that law was the rescission of that portion of the Voting Rights Act, also intent on rolling back voting rights under the Voting Rights Act of 1965. More of this history coming up in our further discussion right here on The Maggie Dawn Show. Continue in this final segment of the first hour of the Maggie Dawn Show, talking all about voting rights, the history of voting rights, up, down, and in between, and talking now about recent times when, in the wake of the Shelby County decision, many states around the country no longer required to get pre-clearance by the U.S. Department of Justice, enacting laws, again, contrary to the language of the Voting Rights Act, those portions now found unconstitutional by a divided Supreme Court, doing things to effectively turn back the clock and attempting effectively in many ways to prevent people of color, language minorities from voting. We know as well, 2016, the presidential election of that time and claims of voter fraud in the wake of that. President Trump was elected despite losing the popular vote. He and his supporters made the claim that large numbers of people had voted illegally during the course of that, a claim that continues to resonate again in the 2020 election as well, that notion that there is voter fraud rampant in America. We know not only because of the challenges to the 2020 election, but based upon an awful lot of reliable and credible statistical reporting by reviewing records and documents that voting fraud in America at any high levels simply does not exist. The 2016 election was not the result of voter fraud. The 2020 election was not the result of voter fraud. A Washington Post analysis, in fact, was able to find only 4 documented cases of voter fraud in the 2016 election out of about 135 million ballots cast, and yet it gives birth to this continuing notion in America, lasting to this day, that somehow voter fraud is affecting and challenging the ultimate results in the 2020 election and even in other voting situations going forward since that time. In the wake of that, we get yet another Supreme Court case challenging under another provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, which is the basic provision of the law.
that prohibits discrimination based upon race and language discrimination. That's the fundamental notion behind the Voting Rights Act, Section 2. Now, an attack upon that section in a case called Brnovich versus Democratic National Committee in 2021. The case percolates up, and in 2021, a majority of the Supreme Court, written by Sam Alito at the time, introduced some new understandings of Section 2, basically eviscerates, almost completely eviscerates, the impact of that fundamental notion in Section 2 prohibiting discrimination based upon race and language. The court says this: we decline in these cases to announce a test to govern all Voting Rights Act challenges that specify the time, place, or manner for casting ballots. However, they go on to say this: it is sufficient for present purposes to identify some guideposts that lead to the court's decision in these cases. Now, these cases were coming out of Arizona. They were specific attacks, challenges to two pieces of legislation enacted by legislatures there, who now in the wake of Shelby County, enacting these laws, one of them having to do with prohibiting people from gathering votes and getting ballots to a voting location, also prohibiting the counting of votes if they happen to be improperly voted, submitted at a particular polling place. Particular pieces of legislation, the Supreme Court upholds those decisions, those legislative determinations by Arizona, and says under Section 2, nothing wrong with restricting access, restricting the counting of those kinds of votes if they fall in those categories. And the court lays out some guideposts that basically suggest that if the extent of the voting fraud, the voting problem is not especially great, then they will pass muster. They say things like this: you consider the size of the burden created by the rule, the degree to which the rule deviates from past practices, that's the reference to history, the size of the racial imbalance. In other words, if there's not a huge racial imbalance, maybe again those laws will pass muster. The overall level of opportunity afforded voters in considering all election rules. The impact of those standards is, of course, that it limits the impact of Section 2 and establishes, again, under Brnovich, a diminution of the Voting Rights Act under Section 2 going forward, which remains an enforcement mechanism, but nonetheless, that is the world in which we live to this day in the wake of this passage in the 1960s of this landmark legislation. Now, once again, there are major pieces of legislation always introduced in Congress to fix Brnovich, to address the things that the United States Supreme Court said were problematic, to change those standards, to return them to a way that Section 2 can be enforced in a reasonable and rational way. Those pieces of legislation, again, introduced over time, they have not gotten the light of day. They have not gotten to a president's desk because of attempts inside our Congress to stop those legislative enactments from fixing, under Shelby County and Brnovich, the problems that we now identify in voting rights enforcement under the civil rights laws. We know as well the Supreme Court continues to address issues related to voting rights. We know that just last term, in the previous term, not this one, but the previous term, in a case coming out of Alabama, a majority of the Supreme Court, yes, indeed, including the Chief Justice, including Brett Kavanaugh and three other members of the Supreme Court, five members of the Supreme Court, finding that Alabama had engaged in invidious, overt discrimination when it came to doing some gerrymandering, some drawing of lines in Alabama that basically disenfranchised a major portion of the voting population in Alabama, and return that to the lower court for the creation of new maps there. This term, again, we have a case coming out of South Carolina. Supreme Court will issue its decision presumably in June, again, under the Voting Rights Act, under this gerrymandering standard, having to do with the intersection between political gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering. That case coming out of South Carolina, as the Supreme Court continues to wrestle with all of this, as America continues to wrestle with issues related to voting in our nation, our history, our movement forward, sometimes our movement backwards, continuing advocacy to ensure as we go to the polls here in the state of Wisconsin coming up very soon, 4 days from now, that the rights of people to vote are sacrosanct, they are supported, they're enforced in our courts and also on a regular basis
in our polling booths, our places of elections. Again, when we come back after this top of the hour break, I'm going to be joined by Kristen Hansen. We're going to get into the implications of all this history. We're going to talk about Wisconsin. We're going to talk about challenges that we have, good things going on, the mechanisms by which you can vote and should be voting here in the state of Wisconsin and in every single community in our great state. Stay with us for that continuing discussion right here on The Maggie Dawn Show.
True justice and you fight.